From CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC Arts on Air. We're your hosts, Brittany Dugan
and Rachel Sanders. On each program, we feature the ideas and stories of students, faculty, and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia.
This evening on the program, we speak with Molly Babel and students working at the Speech in Context Lab. Molly is an associate professor in linguistics and director of the lab.
So we drop by the lab, which is such an interesting little spot. It looks like a little cottage just in between West Mall and Main Mall, and is apparently one of the oldest buildings on campus.
Yes, an ironing board cupboard and all.
I'm finding that's one of the best things about producing Arts on Air. We've been getting to go all over campus this year and visit places that we might never otherwise get a chance to visit.
It's so true. And we get to find out about the fascinating research that goes on inside these buildings. The thing that caught my attention about the work done at Speech and Context Lab was how much language is about perception and production. So not just what we're saying, but how we're perceiving it and physically how it's produced.
We had so much to ask Molly and her students about their experiments and how their findings could be applied to everyday life.
Walking up the stairs to the speech lab. Oh, look at this.
Yeah, so they're like these little cubbies that are, you know, private, but yeah, not weirdly private. You're not locked in a room. We have them designed this way because they create a more natural listening environment. If you go right into a really sound-treated room, it sounds weird, so talk weird. You don't listen in the same way. I'm Molly Babel, and I'm the director of the Speech and Context Lab at UBC. In this lab, we study a number of things related to speech processing. So we're interested in phonetic variation. Everybody sounds different, so we're interested in the basic question of how we all understand each other despite that acoustic variability. And what are the cognitive mechanisms that we use? What are the strategies we use as listeners to understand all these variable accents and speakers and dialects that we're exposed to?
Okay, and how long has this lab been here at UBC?
So I've been at UBC since 2009, and we had a CFI grant to build this lab or kind of reconfigure it in 2010 or 2011. I actually don't remember when we kind of began with our purple walls and green chairs, which is kind of the instantiation that we're in now.
You were saying this is one of UBC's oldest buildings?
Yeah, so there's some debate. Within linguistics, we refer to it as the oldest building on campus. And there's an old picture somewhere in the building of about 100 years ago, a bunch of students and their cattle outside of the building. So it used to be something related to dairy practices, I guess. I'm not sure. Yeah.
And now it's all about speech.
Yeah, that's right.
How's it been going?
It's been going great. So we're a really productive lab, particularly within linguistics. We run a couple thousand participants through various kinds of speech experiments every year. And a lot of the times we try really hard to make these experiments and the questions that we ask relevant to students at UBC. So we're interested in kind of UBC's multilingualism, multiculturalism, and how that plays into kind of neat things that we do as listeners in terms of kind of adapting to that variation, but also kind of the negative stereotypes that we have about listeners and kind of the negative consequences of those stereotype behaviors.
Can you give an example?
Yeah, so a couple of years ago, Jamie Russell and I, who's now a graduate student at McGill, did a project for her honors thesis looking at people's ability to understand Asian Canadian speakers and white Canadian speakers. So we had a set of 12 different speakers and voices that we used for this experiment, and all of them were born and raised in Richmond, so they were all local speakers of Canadian English. And we did a couple different things in this experiment where we put noise over people's voices so that it's harder to understand, because it's generally easy to understand a voice that with an accent that you're familiar with without noise on top of it. And we had listeners just type out the words that they heard in these sentences. And we did this in two kinds of guises. So we did it where they were just looking at these plus, plus, pluses on the screen to kind of fixate. And then we also had a condition where listeners saw the picture of the speaker they were about to hear. And listeners did worse on the Asian Canadian voices only when they knew they were listening to Asian Canadians. And we did a couple kind of additional questions with our listeners and follow-ups to this to see kind of what was going on. And it seems like listeners have this assumption that if you're Asian Canadian, you're going to have a non-native accent. And so they kind of brought that to the table in terms of kind of fighting through this noise, expecting a signal that they didn't actually get. And so that lowered intelligibility. But it's an example of kind of these stereotypes that we develop about speakers, where it's useful to make generalizations sometimes about the way people talk, because it's going to help you in listening conditions, but those generalizations might not actually be true and they can lead you astray in certain contexts.
So when I first read about the Speech and Context Lab, I was thinking about an experience I had last summer working at CBC. Slightly traumatic, an anonymous troll tweeted about my voice after one of my first stories aired. I was pretty upset. I remember I told you about it.
I remember, yeah, vocal fry. There's been a lot written about it over the past couple of years, so you're in good company.
Well, at least there's that. So anyways, we had to ask.
The phenomena that kind of is talked about as vocal fry in the media is related to the way that we vibrate our vocal folds and how much air we let through each what we call glottal cycle. So if people who are listening want to put their hands on their necks and just make a sound, they should be able to get their hand in a place where they feel their vocal folds vibrating. And within each one of those cycles, you're letting some amount of air through. And if you're limiting the amount of air through with each cycle, you're going to end up with a creakier voice like this, where there's a longer closure associated with each of those cycles. So in the media, this has been talked about a lot because, well, I mean, as you said, people love to hate on women's voices, and women's voices in particular have been picked on for this. From a professional perspective, it's kind of amusing because men do this just as much as women do. There's no empirical evidence to show that women are more likely to do this than men. People just really enjoy picking on women's voices. And we do have some projects in the lab that are looking at, well, when you don't like a voice, does that affect what you learn from it? And so far, it seems like no, it might affect some kind of generalization of that learning pattern, but generally, what you hear is what you're learning from, and you can hate on it all you want, but you just are going to have to live with it because, yeah.
Can you describe that experiment? How do you go through that with participants?
Yeah, so this experiment, we can actually pull up some of the stimuli of this one if you'd like to.
That'd be great.
Yeah, yeah. Here is kind of the way this experiment is set up is that participants listen to a story, and some of these stories are a normal pronunciation of these words, and then we have two versions of these stories that have these shifted what we call back vowels, and I'll play some of those for you to listen to. But within that back vowel kind of condition, we have two different versions of it. We have the speaker reading this story in her normal pleasant voice, and then we have her reading the story in an unpleasant voice, but with that same sort of shifted vowel. So give you a snippet of what this sounds like.
The Adventures of Pinocchio, Chapter 1. I don't know how this happened, yet the fact remains that one morning, which began as a normal morning, but quickly became anything but normal.
So that's the normal pronunciation of it. So here's the shifted version.
The Adventures of Pinocchio, Chapter 1. I don't know how this happened, yet the fact remains that one marnin, which began as a normal marnin, but quickly became anything but normal. This piece of wood found itself in the shaft of an old carpenter.
So what we do is we play listeners either one of those stories, and then we have kinds of tests at the end to see, well, do they recognize the word marning now as a production of the word morning? But so we're interested in, and so basically, if you hear the shifted vowel condition, you learn that these back-shifted vowels are just the way the speaker produces these words. And so you kind of readily adapt to this, and you're like, okay, well, the speaker talks like this. So we're interested in comparing listeners' ability to learn from that one to this one that we call kind of the unpleasant voice.
The Adventures of Pinocchio, Chapter 1. I don't know how this happened, yet the fact remains that one marnin, which began as a normal marnin, but quickly became anything but normal, this piece of wool...
You find yourself almost just distracted, thinking, who is this woman, and where is she in the world, and why is she so disinterested in this story of Pinocchio?
Yeah, so, I mean, one thing about this this manipulation that we're doing here is it's not exactly the same kind of thing as the kind of voices that we hear from women in the media that people like to complain about, because, yeah, this voice also is very not interested in reading this story, but we wanted to kind of set it up as this first pass of this is a less pleasant voice to listen to than the other voice, and we want to see if people learn as much when they hear the story in the unpleasant voice. And it seems like listeners are learning pretty much the same thing that they do in the pleasant voice condition, which is comforting that it's not that listeners kind of turn off their ability to understand someone if they don't like the voice, but it also kind of creates this like struggle of, well, what's the solution then? We just have to tell people to tough it out. If you don't like a voice, you're going to listen and learn anyway. It seems like a hard message kind of to sell.
So what do you say? What's the solution there?
What's the solution, you guys?
More research. Well, I'd love to hear from some of you guys about your project. So students are a big part of the lab. You're the director, but there are how many undergrads and how many? I think that I just saw one graduate student.
Let's see. Right now, there are 3 undergraduate honors theses being written right now and 2 other kind of, actually 3 other kind of undergraduate student-led projects that we're working on. Zoe's here and she's writing her dissertation, collecting data in the lab. Kia's a first-year graduate student, or first-year PhD. What is what? Kia's a graduate student, and this is she's doing a research project in the lab, and then I have a master's student who's also doing work in the lab right now.
Okay, yeah. Well, let's go around the room.
My name is Kia. I'm a first-year graduate student in the linguistics department here, and I'm just getting started working with Molly here in the lab. First project that I'm working on it relates to language learning, like adult language learning. I spent a couple of years between my undergrad and graduate work at a children's language school in Seattle, working, teaching Spanish through immersion, working with a lot of teachers, training, helping design curriculum. And one of the challenges the main challenge that kids face is, can they stay engaged? Given the opportunity to be immersed and learn, the kids will get there. Whereas with adults, if you expose them to the language, if you give them the same amount of time, it's different. Like, the challenges are much different for adults. And to me, those are really interesting. It's like, what makes it more challenging for adults to perceive speech sounds in a foreign language, for instance? And what are the ways that we, using technology, because it's at our fingertips, what ways could we use that technology to improve the way that adults learn the sounds of a foreign language?
I challenge you to try to learn Spain Spanish from a guy from Scotland, which I did, and it was challenging.
Well, I had the good fortune to learn Chilean Spanish from Chileans, which, depending who you ask, is also a challenge.
Fair. And what do you hope? You're just starting, but where do you see yourself after UBC?
I won't say it's a pipe dream, but it's definitely a long ways away, is to sort of think about, like, so if I'm an English speaker trying to learn Cantonese, we know what the different sound systems are like. We know what, like, we can figure out what the challenges are. So we know what we're starting with and what we're going to. And the question is then, what changes could I make to the Cantonese speech signal that would make it easier for me as an English speaker to figure out what the important sounds are? So it's like, I could think of it as like an audio filter that you could, like, I mean, in the same way that people like put filters on their Instagram photos. It's like, what filter could I put on this sound to accentuate the features that would make it easier for me to discriminate, listen, and ultimately learn?
Hi, I'm Brianne, and I'm in my 5th year of speech sciences in the Department of Linguistics. I've been working in the lab as a research assistant for about 2 years now.
And what exactly do you do in the lab?
So right now I'm doing my honors thesis, but I've also been involved in a number of different projects. So I prepare stimuli, everything from recording people, getting them all ready, programming the actual experiment and testing it, and then a lot of my time in the lab is spent running participants through the actual experiments. Do I have a burning question? There's so much I want to know. I'm really interested in what I'm doing now, which is how we understand people when there are multiple people talking at the same time. And I'm really interested in sort of atypical speech signals, so unfamiliar accents, what if it's a synthetic speech, how we can sort of learn to cope with and adapt to those different speech signals. One of the areas that I'm really interested in is how we can understand these atypical speech signals so that we can help people who may have difficulty understanding speech, either they have hearing loss, or how we can understand people who have less typical productions of speech. So I'm interested in how to interface that clinical work with the research. So in my project, I'm looking at how people understand speech when there are two people talking at the same time, specifically when one of these accents is a familiar accent, like Canadian English, like I'm speaking now, and when you have an unfamiliar accent, like British accent, which is also a native accent of English, but it's probably one that listeners in Vancouver are less familiar to. So here's an example of two speakers speaking British accented English. They're going to say these very scripted sentences, which sound like you're playing a game of Battleship. So you're going to hear two speakers speaking at the same time, and you have to try and figure out what the coordinate is from the speaker who says blue.
Lays blue in A9 again. Lays blue in A9 again.
I can't say A9 again.
That is really challenging. It sounds like a new language altogether.
So I'll play you one where there's a male speaker and a female speaker, and that should be a little bit easier to segment the two voices.
Okay, I'm going to try harder.
Lay red at D8 soon. Lay red at D8 soon.
I can only really hear him.
Okay, let me try one more, which should be a little bit easier.
I shouldn't be part of your experiment. I wouldn't be a good participant.
Listeners actually do very well at this. They were doing too well, so I had to make the experiment harder. So when you do this 240 times, you start to learn how to do it.
There's hope.
Lay blue with C5, please. Lay blue with C5, please.
Okay, and that time I mostly just heard her.
Right. And so she was the speaker saying blue, so that one you could get the answer, which was C5, and so that one's actually a little bit easier because there are two separate accents, there are two separate genders, and the listener, which you have to pay attention to, is louder. So we have all these factors playing in together here.
My name is Zoe Lam. I'm a PhD student at the Department of Linguistics, and I'm a member in this lab.
And do you have a specific role in the lab?
I do work here. I run participants here for my PhD dissertation project about heritage speakers in Canada. So a lot of non-official languages are spoken at home in Canada, like Punjabi, Cantonese, Tagalog, and I'm interested in adults who were raised in an environment where their parents speak a non-official language, and then when they go to school, they pick up English, and then English became their dominant language. So I'm interested in this specific population to see how they perceive speech sounds in their heritage language.
What's the most interesting thing you've discovered since you've been working here?
I discovered that actually heritage speakers are pretty good when they perceive speech sounds in their heritage language. So that is something optimistic, yeah. After I get my degree, I hope to do something about promoting heritage languages in North America, because a lot of parents think their children should only learn English to be a functional member in the society, but actually we're able to be multilingual speakers, so we should be able to speak the official language, but at the same time, it's good to maintain a heritage language because we know a lot of benefits of multilingualism.
What are they?
For example, there's this term called mental dexterity. So we can process sensory information more flexibly. I hope all people raised in Canada who speak a different language at home should believe that they are special, because a lot of those speakers that I meet, they're ashamed of their proficiency in their heritage language because they may not be as fluent as other speakers from the homeland country. So I want to tell them, oh, you're special, you're good. So love your love your ability to teleport between different cultures because of your multilingual ability.
Hi, I'm Loretta. I'm a fourth year undergrad student in speech sciences, and I'm doing my undergrad honors thesis here at this lab.
What's your thesis about?
I'm looking at sound change in Cantonese English bilinguals. And so there's this phenomenon in Cantonese, it's called, people call it lanyam, or kind of lazy pronunciation, and so people have noticed these changes going on. It's like variation. You can pronounce certain words multiple ways, but it's like changing over time. And so I'm kind of looking at older and younger speakers in Vancouver and also in Hong Kong and how they differ in these pronunciations.
What will your research do next, or in an everyday environment? Who will it benefit?
I feel like a lot of people think these changes are because people are being lazy, not saying things correctly. The kids are saying things all wrong. But I think if people know more about this, they know it's actually a natural process. It's not about saying things wrong. It's just changing. It's like words change. People use different things over time. Like no one uses like groovy anymore, but no one really cares. But people care a lot about this. And a lot of people, especially heritage speakers here, think that they're saying things wrong. They lose confidence in learning the language. And it also affects like education, how you teach these people. Like, do you tell them, like, maybe don't tell them, you know, it's wrong. Just say, this is another way to say it, something like that.
Were you told it's wrong? Is that what inspired this thesis?
It's something I was aware of. I guess I was told a little bit, like, yeah, you're not saying it right. You're always saying it funny. And a lot of people have this experience. And I just think it's a really interesting kind of phenomenon. Okay, so my experiment has two parts. There's a perception and production portion. So for perception, what participants are doing, they're hearing different pronunciations of these words, and they have to decide what word they heard from two options. Since I was looking at sound change, these are words where originally they were separate, so they would have been different words based on pronunciation, but due to the sound change, they could be pronounced the same way. So this first, these stimuli are speech continua from one sound all the way to the other in 13 steps. So there's 13 different pronunciations. And the specific word is the Cantonese word for to cheat someone, or, well, it could be either. And so it starts either with a vowel, and it goes all the way to starting with a nasal sound that sounds like nga. So I'll play that for you right now.
What is the participant asked to respond to?
Right, so they only hear one of these, so there's 13 different pronunciations. They'll hear one, and they decide what word they heard. And there's two options. One is to cheat, and the other is to shake hands. So originally, one was ah, and the other one was nga. But if people have a merged kind of category, it could have been either word. So you want to tell, you want to know what word they thought they heard based on the pronunciation. And if they have moved on to the full sound change, they've totally merged. There shouldn't be able to tell what word they heard based on the pronunciation. It would be like 50-50 either way. You can't really tell.
Right. Are participants, I mean, just around the corner is where you do some of these experiments. Are they asked to close their eyes and listen, or like what other stimulants are involved?
That's a good question. So with an experiment like Loretta's here, they're they'll have buttons associated with one of these responses, and it's not changing up through the course of the experiment, those kind of button assignments. So sometimes I can imagine listeners, and also I guess in Brianne's experiment where you're trying to separate these two voices that are in competition, closing your eyes to kind of ignore any other input that you might be getting and just focusing on that. But our little cubbies are kind of these private yet not creepy cubbies that we put participants in, and so they don't have a lot of interesting visual stimuli to look at unless it's something we're presenting in the context of the experiment. But you're right that when you're doing a hard auditory task, lots of people close their eyes as a way to kind of shut down one sensory system in order to focus on the ears.
Absolutely. I also imagine that if it's recorded, that's neutral. But if you were, for example, having to do that live, you might give away just in your body expression that you were trying to make something either nasally or not.
Yeah. So for things like with Loretta's project, where a lot of these mergers have to do with sounds that are produced in different parts of the mouth, if we did this live with a talker who you could see, you'd have a lot of cues. Because one of the mergers that Loretta's looking at is so a nasal that you make by closing your lips versus a nasal you make by, it's the sound, same sort of sound that we have at the end of the word thing in English. And if you look at me, you can tell whether I'm saying or but if you're not looking at someone, those are acoustically really quite similar sounds. So we definitely wouldn't want to do this kind of experiment live because it would give away a lot of information.
Yeah, so I do interviews with participants afterwards to see what they say, and a lot of times I have to stare at them when they're doing the mm or mm difference to see if they actually make the difference, because if I'm just listening, I'll miss what they said. It's very hard to tell apart.
Right. What's something you wish the UBC, the greater community, knew about your lab and the work you're doing here?
If there's anything that I want people to know, it's related to speakers being highly variable, and listeners also have the responsibility to follow that variability, because that variability is meaningful in terms of speakers' identity. There are parts of it that are kind of inevitable consequences of being complex organisms full of a bunch of meat in our mouths. And so speech is this complicated dance that involves the listener and the speaker, and we kind of both have to be, we have to be understanding on both sides that kind of variability is this awesome thing and can also be this challenge.
That was Molly Babel, Associate Professor in Linguistics and Director of the Speech and Context Lab. We were joined by student research assistants as well. You can learn more about the lab by checking out speechincontext.arts.ubc.ca.
If you missed some of that feature, you can visit our website at artsonair.com, where we'll be posting the podcast tomorrow. You've been listening to UBC Arts on Air on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Join us in 2 weeks when we'll be dropping by the School of Library, Archival, and Information Studies, also known as iSchool.
We'll be hearing about research into subjects such as social media mining and personal archives. If you'd like more information about our program, you can go to our website, artsonair.com, send us an email at artsonair.info@gmail.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at artsonair.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.